right. Thank you, Vitalik, for joining me on the podcast today. I really appreciate it. You were kind enough to be one of the very first guests on the podcast a few years ago, and it's great to be able to talk to you again. I reached out, you know, a little while ago, wanted to talk about Zuzulu and, you know, at the time, the OpenAI, Sam Altman sort of dispute was very hot and unresolved at that point. And I want to get your perspective on that because I know historically you've been very interested and somewhat involved with the effective altruism movement. And now, you know, we've got EAC and those two sort of butted heads with this dispute in a way that I found to be sort of frustratingly toxic and tribal. And I thought you might have sort of a nuanced view. And then, you know, so that's what I want to talk about. And then to my delight, you actually put out a piece called My Techno Optimism, which, you know, very clearly shared your perspective. And I think that was just great for the issue overall and for people paying attention because it was much more nuanced than, you know, a little tweet of let's go EAC or, you know, stop all AI or anything like that. So what I'd like to do today, you know, as we discussed before, is to just sort of like walk through your piece a little bit, but hopefully, you know, talk on a lot of questions that you didn't explicitly address so people can go and read it, you know, beforehand or after the fact and hopefully get something additional, you know, hopefully a lot additional from this conversation as well. So I guess the best place to start would be what motivated you to write this piece in the first place? Was it some combination of, you know, the increasing EAC movement or, you know, Mark Andreessen's piece, which you mentioned, or the dispute or kind of all of the above or something else?
Yeah. And so I started thinking about a lot of these ideas, like basically, actually in the week that Mark Andreessen's piece came out. This was back in October. And I remember reading it, and I remember seeing the responses to it. And I remember getting this distinct impression that there's some kind of missing perspective that hasn't really made it out anywhere in public yet. And so I actually started thinking about whether or not I should write some kind of piece and just go out and try to write the piece that I thought should exist myself. And at the same time, use that as an opportunity to really finish putting a lot of my thoughts on some of these topics together. It was interesting because a lot of these issues were issues that I'd been thinking about in the back of my mind a lot throughout this whole year. I thought a lot about them while Zuzulu was happening in the spring, just because of how effectively that event brought together, I mean, like both a lot of crypto people, but also a lot of people interested in AI and bio and some of these other topics. And one of the challenges that was going through my mind is that I noticed that I had these thoughts and opinions on crypto, and then separately, I had these thoughts and opinions on bio, and then separately, I had these thoughts and opinions on effective altruism and morality and you know, like ethics and all of those questions. And then separately, I had my thoughts on, I mean, like AI and the singularity, and they weren't really in you know, what the cool kids call a reflective equilibrium with each other, right? Like, I didn't feel like I, these separate strands of thoughts that I had were yet consistent or really, how would I put it? Like,
they didn't
like
tie
make
together.
Sense in the context of each other.
Yeah.
And so I started thinking in more detail and just making sure that I was properly updating toward, like what we've seen over the last couple of years in technology, some of the very negative things that we've seen over the last couple of years in politics, some of the trends that we've seen in other spaces. Also, the things that I really like and value and respect, and also some of the things that I disrespect in the crypto space, and like basically how all of those things might fit together into one common picture. And so I started thinking about the piece. And generally when I write things, there's like a period when I write it, which usually kind of lasts maybe 2 or 3 days, that includes a couple of stretches of a couple of hours each. Then there's a period of reaching out for feedback, collecting feedback, thinking about the feedback, and then finally publishing it. But then before that, there's definitely a longer period where I spent the time just thinking through those issues. And often by the time my keyboard hits the HackMD editor, like three quarters of what I have in mind is like kind of figured out in my head already, though often the process of writing itself does end up revealing important kind of points I hadn't considered or contradictions and so forth. And then it just so happened that the week after this, ZooConnect was happening, right? And ZooConnect was the Zuzaloo gathering that was meant as a sister event in some ways to DevConnect, right? So DevConnect is the annual Ethereum sort of conference, sort of unconference, right? So you might have heard of DevCon, and which is the annual Ethereum conference, which is, of course, a parody of DEFCON with an F, which is the even more famous security conference. But then last year we started doing DevConnect, which is like a version of DevCon, but where things are more distributed and it's more about many independent events instead of relying on the Ethereum Foundation to organize everything. And so last year there was a DevConnect and a DevCon, and then this year there is a DevConnect instead of a DevCon, and next year there's going to be a DevCon again. So mix and matching the styles a bit. But alongside this, there was ZooConnect, which was the Zuzaloo community, but gathering together for 2 weeks inside of a city. Basically having the same kinds of discussions that we had inside of Zuzaloo. Continuing along a lot of those threads, also in a somewhat lighter weight way and not kind of insisting that everyone live in the same place for 2 whole months. So a lot of the same people were there, and that gave me a lot of opportunities to talk to a lot of interesting people about crypto, about AI, also about brain-computer interfaces, right? So it was interesting. I had a lot of chats with Juan Bennett from Filecoin and IPFS over the last half year or so. And he mentioned to me how he was really bullish on this concept of like brain-computer interfaces and leading up to essentially merging with AI instead of creating totally separate kind of AI. And I remember I found this direction compelling. And then also in October, I had read the new Elon Musk biography. And I learned there that like Elon was convinced about the exact same idea. And then I learned that a couple of other people were convinced about the exact same idea. And Milan Cvetkovic, researcher who has been really involved in the BCI space, also had a good chance to talk to him. So it was in this kind of environment where I got to see and understand a lot of these other scientific trends better. And then, of course, all of the ongoing COVID research stuff, which I've been involved in ever since Crypto Relief and Balvi started a couple of years ago. So started writing and started putting together my own perspective, which is basically, I really believe in the value of technology as you do, and as I know lots of your guests do because I've listened to them. And I see just like how much technology improves the lives of people just really massively, and how easy that is to underappreciate. But at the same time, taking a lot of the AI safety arguments seriously, and taking seriously some of the issues that I see in some of the other tech sectors, right? So issues around computer security, issues around some of the things that crypto is trying to solve, social media issues.
We basically put that together into a common picture. And so this concept of DEAC, which is sort of a little bit intentional, ambiguous, primarily defense acceleration, but also with a touch of democracy and decentralization, is basically where a lot of those ideas came from. And that's what the post is about.
Great. Well, thank you for all that context. It's super helpful, and sort of wasn't aware of the backstory, so it's really interesting. A couple of things just at a macro level. First of all, I love that you took the time to write this. Obviously, it's much easier to fire off a tweet, but to bring all of these super complex threads together in your head and write a nuanced piece as you did to, like you said, bring your own you know, to develop your own perspective even further. It's like hard to mash these things all together in your head, but through the writing process, and it's sort of like an iterative form of thinking in a way. So you write it and then you iterate and then you write it and you iterate and you actually develop your own thoughts. And then at the end, you have a, you know, the ability to share that in a very coherent way with the public. So appreciate you doing that. And I know like you're a big fan of long form. I'm a big fan of long form. I think you took a time off of Twitter where you were just doing long form. So I don't know how to make that like more popular, because just you have to take the time to, you know, to write it and to read it. But I wish we had more of that sort of, you know, Twitter. If Twitter is sort of the town square, I wish the town square had a little bit more, was like a system that was built a little bit more for nuance. So anyway, when we do have these opportunities, I really appreciate it. One question, you know, that comes to mind early, I think to your point, you know, I identify as like a techno-optimist. You identify as a techno-optimist, but it's not so simple as to say like, oh, everything that, you know, EAC supports, I'm like, you know, it's no question. This is all like super easy. Let's just move forward. Like, this is all obvious stuff. That's where the tribal kind of stuff starts to come in. And I don't even know, you know, DEAC is what you've sort of named your perspective. I don't even know if I completely identify with that. And I don't think there's really like necessarily an issue with that. I think it's definitely the closest to my perspective. And I probably have to take the time to sort of write out my own in order to even know exactly what it is. But nonetheless, I love your view on it. One of the things you sort of point out very early, like as sort of a, you know, set the stage a little bit, is that, you know, you are a very strong believer that technology makes the world a better place. And moreover, that humans are fundamentally good. You talk about, you know, various examples of, you know, one being the doubling of lifespan over the last century, and all of these different examples of how tech has made the world better. And you talk about how it's sort of like generally delaying technology in most cases can be like very punitive. But are there examples where rushing technology has been negative in the past, or are you sort of just treating AI as maybe sort of an unprecedented time where accelerating too fast could be negative to the point where it is, you know, irreversible? And even, you know, you bring up the environment being sort of like the one big exception to the last 100 years where the environment was a negative consequence. But with the environment, no one's claiming, oh, this is going to extinct humanity or this is completely reversible. And in fact, you express optimism that we can solve that issue just as we've solved pollution and other environmental related issues in the past. So, you know, AI is a little bit different. It's like, this could extinct humanity. This could be sort of fixed once it happens, and it could sort of have like a takeoff where it's irreversible. So I guess, do you think of other examples where we maybe have rushed things too much? And how is AI like sort of different from, you know, climate and other issues in the past?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think you're right. Like, I would not even put like pollution into the category of things being bad because technology progresses too fast. Because like, if you think about a hypothetical world where technology progresses 10 times more slowly, then like, instead of having a 1.5 century fossil fuel era, we would have had a 15th century fossil fuel era, right? And you know, like, instead of a like 1 or 2 or whatever number of centuries it is, era of massive wood burning, that would have been like 10 to 20 centuries. And, you know, things could have easily been much worse for the world, right? So I think the place where things go beyond that, and we can say, like, I would prefer today that this technology had never been developed. I mean, this one is controversial because there are people who have a kind of galaxy brain arguments that it's actually good, but nuclear weapons, right? Like, I would totally want to live in a world where nuclear weapons don't exist. Then it would be nice if we somehow could have the biology that we need to extend our lives and cure diseases and do all of those things without being able to create and manipulate viruses. But that also seems like a combination that's not really possible. Like, I think you can totally move the needle and like be ahead 10 years on one instead of being ahead 10 years on the other. And like, those are the kinds of shifts that I advocate. But like, you can't be a century ahead on one without being a century or 90 years ahead on the other, I think. What are some other examples. There's like a things in the AI surveillance category, which is like not in the AI superintelligence category that kind of get tricky, right? And this is like one of those situations where I also see the good that like having cameras everywhere can do, right? There's this really excellent piece of a Hardcore History episode. I believe it's the second one in the Supernova in the East series, where Dan Clark Carlin basically talks about some of the atrocities that the Japanese did, both in China in 1937, 38, and in other places. And he basically talks about how the fact that technology is like cameras and like media distribution are available, like basically meant that the Japanese ended up suffering, from a just PR and global politics perspective, much more for the atrocities that they committed than they would have 100 or 200 years before that, right? Because for most of human history, just like going into the village and killing all the men because you feel angry, and then raping all the women or children just because he wants to, as like a thing that's pretty normal for conquering armies to do. And it's like an amazing feat of improving human morality that we're in the state now where those kinds of things do bring a response of shock and horror. And media technology making those events just much more visible and much more salient and much more provable is like a really big positive thing, in my opinion, in reducing the extent to which those kinds of things happen, right? And so but then at the same time, there's the other side of the story, which is basically that, like, if you fast forward 80 years, and if you think about like modern surveillance state technology and how the basically, the balance of power between the individual and the state is going pretty quickly into the state direction, like, basically, just because of how easy it is to track people to see everything that happens in the physical world, and even to go after people after the fact, right? This is the sort of thing that's been happening quite a bit in Russia recently, like basic, and not only in Russia, in a lot of places actually, right? Unfortunately, the authoritarians discovered this one clever trick, which is you let the protests happen, and you don't really try too hard to fight against them on the day of the protest, but then you like have your cameras out, you figure out everyone who played any important role in participating in them, and then 3 days later they hear the knock on the door at 2 a.m. and then like 5 years later there aren't any protest leaders left, right? And so that's kind of the dark side of like the combination of just you cameras being really easy to make, and digital technology, and just like fairly modern levels of AI making it easy to analyze everything that happened with them, and like how it could lead to some dark consequences as well. So I feel like, on the whole, it seems like the first century or century and a half of that style of technology improving was probably very good. But if you fast forward and think about kind of the last 20 or 30 years of that branch, then I'm much less confident that it's been a net good, and that's definitely one of the things that I worry about. And then, like, we could get into deep fakes, but that already starts to get into like much kind of heavier forms of AI, probably. And I'm sure there's like lots of other very specific examples, but just those are a couple that come to mind.
Yeah, it's funny you bring up the protesters. I remember like years ago, first when I was first sort of getting into crypto, or at least formulating the best way to like communicate it with people and why it's useful. You bring up like the Ro Russia protests. There was, at the time there was like the pro Hong Kong protests in China, where they would do the same thing. They would like sort of see, who paid for a subway ticket to the protest, and then next thing you know, you don't have access to your funds anymore. And so that's, a big use case for crypto, obviously, and not having, going back to sort of cash in a way where if you pay for your subway ticket in cash, they can't do that. And maybe, crypto is sort of like the next version of that. You put out a poll sort of further to this, sort of idea of delayed technologies, where you know, you were basically asking, would you rather, if we do have this like all powerful AI that's just like, you know, leagues beyond what anyone else has, would you rather have that sort of like in the hands of, you know, the US government, or sort of like a multinational government body, or, you know, an individual corporation, or would you rather delay it 10 years? And the responses were overwhelmingly in favor of delay. And so this, you know, sort of on the one hand, and you're saying that, you know, the costs of delaying technology are huge. It's surprising. And then on the other, where you might advocate for the delay of AI in particular, you know, maybe not so surprising. One of the interesting things from that as well was like people were relatively more against it being in the hands of the US government versus, you know, corporations or even the multinational government, which I thought was kind of interesting. But, you know, obviously like you're very pro decentralization, but do you, and you know, so am I, but do you think we've sort of like overcorrected to where, you know, we have obviously like trust in institutions is at an all-time low, probably, you know, in part due to social media. Like I'd argue that these centralized institutions aren't necessarily acting much worse than they have in the past. It's just all, you know, they can't sort of do it and have us blindly believe anymore because we have access to all this information. So I'm wondering, like, do you think there are cases where centralization, you know, can be good, where, you know, maybe if we do have this all powerful AI and, you know, ideally it would be like, we have this, you know, democracy that is able to make all the right decisions and whatnot. But practically speaking, you know, could it be beneficial to have it sort of in the hands of, you know, a small party that can be trusted? Like, for example, for me, you know, you're one of the people at the top of my list, the people in the world who, like, if we had something this powerful, I would sort of trust you and, you know, sort of whoever you deem trustworthy around you to sort of, you know, make the right decisions around this thing. Even though it's like an impossible task, at least I would know that I think your values and principles are sort of aligned with mine, and like you're sort of very logical and not, you know, as we can sort of see with this piece, not prone to getting like overly tribal and things like that. How would you have, you know, voted on that survey if you don't mind sharing, or just your general sort of, you know, perspective on the way that those results went?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what I found interesting philosophically about that survey is that if you think about how economists usually talk about why monopolies are bad, economists usually tell you that monopolies are bad because they underproduce, right? A monopoly is bad because they constrict prices and like they push prices to way above what the competitive level would be. And as a result, lots of people aren't able to afford things, right? Like in pretty much like most fields, like in pharma, for example, like that basically is the story, right? But what's interesting about that approach is that if you look at that approach, then like having a monopolist is still much better than having nothing, right? And over here, we basically have a bunch of polls where in 9 out of 9 cases, people said, well, no, having nothing is better than having a monopolist, right? And the reason basically is that people are not worried about the monopolist underproducing something. They're basically worried about like how the distribution of the technology affects power relationships, right? And I think this ties into kind of one of the big ways in which technology has really changed over the last 20 years or so, which is basically that technology became much more networked. And by becoming much more networked, technology also turned into a network of power, right? Like, if you imagine, you know, an evil corporation 50 years ago selling you something, like, what could the corporation do? Like, the corporation could overcharge and make something that's lower quality than it was supposed to be. The corporation could even make a product that poisons you. But the corporation does not really have a viable path to exerting power over you, at least 50 years ago, right? Like the closest is probably the sort of quote, you know, razor blade model, where you make a product that's like dependent on kind of spare parts that have to constantly be rebought and renewed, and then it turns out that the company is just the only one that's able to actually sell you those parts. But like your margin for exerting power over people by producing things that they use is like relatively low, right? And then especially if you compare it to today, when
if you use a service provided by a corporation, like the corporation can see everything that you do, they can arbitrarily cut you off, they can pressure you in various ways that change your behavior, they can do very fine-grained things that depend on how you use their service, like you can do all kinds of things, right? And so technology as a power network is like a thing that exists today in a way that's like much deeper than it existed in the in the pre-internet era. And so in terms of the question of like to what extent we should be scared of this, I think it's interesting, right? Because like there definitely is a tendency for a lot of people to have a kind of overly conspiracy theory mentalities on these kinds of questions. But then the other thing that you have to remember is like the world is much bigger than America, and there's like entire audiences that are massive across the world that do view the US government with like almost you know, a similar level of suspicion to how a lot of people in the US view the Chinese government, right? And like to me, the idea that we should try to build a world where in order to participate in that global economy, you should just have to trust the government of a country where you've possibly never been, like that just feels grossly unfair, right? And that's like that's something that I can definitely have a lot of empathy for. And like there's definitely stuff that you know, the US government has done even in the last 5 or 10 years that totally justify that, like a lot of people having that low level of confidence. So like I definitely don't like do prefer to try to move toward a world where in order to have access to the best tools, people don't have to like have a positive attitude to like any you know, like one single country or one single corporation. I mean, the multinational thing, right? I think like that one's interesting because like I think one thing that's important to just kind of point out here for the listeners is that there was an actual AI safety proposal called MAGIC. This is the Multilateral AGI Consortium, right? It's something that a bunch of people, I forget from where, but it felt like kind of like vaguely Oxford effective altruist bubble people, but I mean, I don't remember exactly, like basically proposed this idea that AI above some threshold should be banned worldwide, except that there should be one multinational body that's empowered to do that research. And if you as a country sign on to the treaty that bans doing AI development outside of this consortium, then you get to equitably share in the benefits of using and commercializing the technology that gets developed inside of the consortium. And this to me reads like a well-intentioned best effort of you know, like how do we solve for fairness and for the benefits of AGI existing and for maximizing safety in a world where any kind of competition is presumed to be super dangerous. But like it was interesting to me that like the majority of the people in all of the polls that I made rejected even that, right? And I think like that's also reasonable because like there are plenty of international bodies that pretends to be international, but that ends up being totally biased to like one geopolitical team or the other. So this all shows like just how difficult it is to like create a thing that actually can be neutral and that actually can get the kind of support that it needs from across the world, right? And which is why, yeah, I mean, it's also part of why the crypto space exists, right? Like the crypto space is, I think, fundamentally pessimistic about the idea of like, can we make a global central bank that we can just reasonably ask everyone to put their trust into? And it basically says like, hey, instead of doing that, let's create open markets and decentralized networks. And DAC is for me asking the question like, okay, if that is not a reasonable ask, then like, how do we create, you know, like AI and a technological future in a way that solves for, you know, like fairness and safety and the technology actually existing and being developed, but
without assuming that we can sort of magic into existence some centralized actors that get trusted by everyone, just because it's so hard to make those kinds of actors as well. And like, let's try to explore what that world looks like.
Right. So one of the things, I mean, you introduced in the beginning, as we talked about, like the fundamental techno-optimist view, but you make the point in your essay how AI is fundamentally different, and you compare it to maybe like the evolution of organisms or even the Industrial Revolution, where we created machines that not in a mental capacity, but in a physical capacity went beyond humans. And I feel like basically with it, it's very hard when you look at, you know, and you pointed this out, that you look at past views on technology, and in almost every case where they were pessimistic, they end up sort of like looking quite bad in retrospect. And yet you're sort of able to put yourself in a position where you've developed the conviction that AI is genuinely different. And despite all previous tech pessimists being basically wrong, I'm going to take a stand here and not sort of go the easy route of, well, let's just accelerate everything and trust that it's going to work out. And I'm going to sort of like trust my gut on this. So I'm curious, like how difficult that is. Like, it would certainly be a lot easier to just be like, oh, you know, EAC, like, let's, you know, let's go, let's accelerate. But you know, it's harder to develop this conviction and this sort of contrarian view that historically has not done well. And it seems like the center point of your sort of like why AI is different seems to revolve around this concept of like instrumental convergence. So maybe you could describe sort of what that is a little bit, and what your view is, and maybe even like your timeline of, is this like an immediate concern that you think AGI is, you know, right around the corner, or is LLMs basically a fancy illusion, but it's actually like sort of the wrong path, and we do have some time to figure this out. So maybe like treating how you're able to sort of treat AI as a standalone, why you do that, how you're able to sort of like gain the conviction to do that. And
So to me, like the core of my argument for why AI and especially kind of superhuman AGI is different is basically because of like it isn't creating a tool, right? It's creating an organism, and it's creating an organism that beats out humans by the exact same metric that humans beat out every other animal on Earth, which allowed us to like basically conquer and genocide the hell out of every other animal on Earth, in many cases even accidentally, despite those animals often being hundreds of times physically stronger than us, right? Like, intelligence is a big deal. And machines are already physically much stronger than we are, especially since the Industrial Revolution. And the mind is like clearly, you know, the thing that makes man man. Like, it's the thing that makes man man as opposed to monkey. And it's the thing that makes man man as opposed to like a car or a machine in a factory. And here, basically, talking about the possibility that like, wait, what if... someone, possibly Altman, is going to create the alternative to man, and it's going to be much smarter than we are. And so the logic goes like, well, if we look at what we did to monkeys and dodos and so mammoths and so many other species, then what's just the most natural outcome about what super intelligent AIs are going to end up doing to us? Now, the second part of the argument, of course, is like basically rebutting the most obvious kind of set of replies to this, which is like, well, but we are going to create those AIs. So why would we give those AIs a goal of doing anything mean to us instead of giving those AIs a goal of loving and protecting us, right? And this is where, like, basically, like, this is the exact question that the last two decades of AI safety theory have been trying to solve and come up with good answers for, right? And it turns out that like actually giving the AI that kind of a goal is like a super hard problem, right? Like there isn't a simple mathematical formula that describes like love or human welfare or peace or people staying alive or any of those things, right? And what the challenge is basically that like you can make something that feels like it approximates what you want when the set of things that you throw at it is just the set of things that's like pretty familiar to humans already. But then once you go outside the distribution, include the possibility of AIs creating something totally new that's beyond our own capability, then things start like really going completely crazy, right? And the example for this that AI safety people usually give is kind of the way that humans have hacked the algorithm that is the process of evolution, right? It's like, if you think about the process of evolution as an agent, the process of evolution as an agent has a goal, which is basically to increase the reproductive fitness of things in their environment. So, you know, if I have my, my genes and my memes, and I have 5 children, you have your genes and your memes, and you have 3 children, then like, guess what? Over time, I'm going to outcompete you. And the next, round of the fight is going to be between, different versions of myself, and sort of the game keeps on going, right? And this gave humans a lot of very understandable urges. Like, we have the desire to stay alive. We have the desire to eat. We have the desire to drink. We have a lot of desires associated with reproduction. But then what we've managed to do is we've managed to hack those desires, right? Like, we've basically managed to say, well, we don't just want to eat food that maximizes our survival and reproductive fitness. We want to eat food that is delicious, right? And the fact that we consider some types of food delicious and not other types of food is like the result of taste preferences that we've acquired through millions of years of evolution, where those millions of years of evolution were trying to solve for the problem of like, what kinds of desires do I give people so that they will eat the things that are good for their survival and fitness. But then in our totally different environment, like those two things diverge. And we know that those two things diverge, and yet people still want food that matches our concept of what is delicious, right? Or the other example is like, we have humans want to reproduce, and in order to reproduce, you need to have sex, and humans wants to have sex, but like we've also created at least half a dozen totally different types of technology to allow us to have sex without actually doing any of the reproducing. And like when we use these technologies, we totally know that we're not doing the thing that Mother Nature intended, and we're totally not like actually helping along the goal that evolution had when evolution gave us these goals, but like we don't care, right? And like that's a metaphor for how super intelligent AIs are going to think, right? Basically, super intelligent AIs, you might give them the goal of, Lex Fridman loves to say, bring, peace and love to the world. And, but then the AI might realize like, wait, it turns out that like I, with my much better thinking power, can come up with this 47 dimensional squiggly. And if I look at this 47 dimensional squiggly, then like it looks to me like the idealized ultimate version of peace and love. And I look at the 47 dimensional squiggly, it looks incredibly peaceful, incredibly lovely, way more lovely than anything in the human world. And so I just, putting myself in the shoes of the AI, I'm just going to go to blow up the world and replace all these humans with these 47 dimensional squigglies that look to me like peace and love, right? If you want like an example of this, in deep learning models especially back in the 2010s, just using deep learning to make images was just like starting to be a thing for the first time, right? Like one of the things that you could do with those models, I don't know if you remember, but like you could obviously run them forwards, right? And you could say, give me an image and it'll tell you if it's a dog. But then you could also run them backwards and you could tell them, solve for creating an image that is as maximally doggy as possible, right? It's like, really take the dog parameter and like push it all the way to infinity. And you get something that's totally not a dog, right? You get something that like has dog shapes in a bunch of places, and it might look like 50 dogs. It might even have like 8 eyes or even, or 32 eyes. It like, it totally, you know, looks like some kind of weird dog demon from hell. But, you know, according to the AI, it maximizes the function that it learns for, you know, what is a dog, right? So the worry is basically that like, no matter how we specify the goal, we're always going to specify the goal imperfectly. And eventually the AI is going to like figure out what that difference is between the goal that we set and the goal that the AI ends up having. And, you know, it's going to end up replacing the world with like whatever version of 12-eyed dogs and 47 dimensional squigglies that maximizes its conception of peace and love in the world, right? Now, instrumental convergence, this is a really important idea, right? And special convergence basically says, for a very, very wide class of different goals that you could have, there are intermediate goals that make a huge amount of sense as steps to take on that journey, right? So one intermediate goal is survival. If you don't survive, you can't accomplish any goals. Another goal is maximizing the amount of power that you have and the amount of resources under your control. The more resources you have, the more you can achieve your goal, pretty much regardless of what your goal is. A third example of this is just like safety, right? So minimizing the number of threats that could be a risk to your survival in the future, or even minimizing the number of threats of things that could reprogram you in your future, right? Because if you get reprogrammed, then like you're not going to be able to follow your original goals anymore, right? And so what that basically means is that for a very large classes of goals, it just is a natural thing to do first to like basically go and destroy humanity and you know, like reconfigure the entire earth into some kind of pattern where it's much, much easier to mine everything to get all of the resources out from it that you want. So that's like basically my kind of 10-minute summary of the sort of AI doomer case. And like, I'm not 100% by the AI, but convinced by the AI doomer case. And I think if I had to kind of argue against the AI doomer case somewhat, I would say, yeah, look at the kinds of AIs that we have in the world today, right? And one thing that you might realize about those AIs is that they are actually over time becoming less like these instrumental goal-driven things that the AI doomer arguments are theorizing about, right? Like if you remember AlphaZero, right? This was the AI that managed to play Go way, way better than humans do without even taking as input any existing Go games. It basically just started with the rules, started with playing against itself, and it just figured out like super, super human play entirely from scratch, right? Now, AlphaZero explicitly had a coded objective function, and it was explicitly trying to maximize for that objective function. Now, fast forward to ChatGPT. ChatGPT does not act like a thing that has goals, right? Like GPT is just act like a thing that essentially puts on the costume of being a particular type of human personality and enacting that personality. And if that personality is not self-consistent, then like so be it, right? Like it doesn't have goals, it just does. And this to me, yeah, like basically shows that like it's very possible that we will figure out how to make AIs that totally don't have these pathologies of like, well, if we want to bring peace and love to the world, then like let's really try hard to maximize what peace and love really means, and let's replace the world with 47 dimensional squigglies, and it'll just do something that feels way more normal than any of us expected. Right. So like that's the counter argument. And so like this is why I said on Twitter that my P-Doom, which is the fancy jargon for basically a probability that AIs are going to cause literal human extinction, is about 10%. Right. Which is that like I think there's a large chance the Doomer story is true, a large chance the Doomer story is totally not true. And within the space of probabilities where the Doomer story is true, there's a very large chance that we're going to figure out how to deal with the problem and solve it, right? So that, but at the same time, like a 10% chance is a freaking big deal, right? Like a 10% chance is larger than the chance that the average person dies from a non-biological cause. And so if you think about like the amount of effort that you personally think about, put into thinking about your physical safety, then like maybe about that same amount of effort is like an amount of effort that's good for humanity to put into making sure AIs don't kill everyone, right? So that's kind of my approximate level of worry and where it comes from and why it might be a risk and why it might not be a risk. And then, I mean, obviously I talk about not just the risk of doom, but also the risk of the AI surveillance dystopia that we went into a little bit, and just the possibility that like, even if that doesn't happen, and even if it creates a world that looks really nice at first glance, so we basically get a kind of Brave New World dystopia that just ends up still feeling incredibly empty from all of our perspectives because humans just become totally disempowered. And so like those different strands are where a lot of my concern about AI in particular lies.
Right. And at the beginning of your piece, you have this, a visual of like, well, some people want to sort of, if we're on a path, right, some people want to go backwards and they think backwards is great, or, you know, the present is great, but the future is all doom. And, you know, EAC would say, you know, the future is all great, we need to get there as quickly as possible. And your more nuanced take is like, well, we don't want to go backwards, but we can go sort of left or right, like oversimplistically. And left is amazing, but right is wrong. Do you sort of reserve some probability that the forward direction, you know, the left, where like the future is great, actually does not involve much development of AI whatsoever? So one example would be like, basically you talk about, you know, probability of doom, or, you know, in the worst case scenario, basically like human extinction as caused by AI. Another situation is we basically end up as like pets, and it's like, well, what's the point? Like humans are sort of devalued and there's really no point to have us. We're just sort of like entertainment almost for the AIs, or like utility for the AIs or something like that. And you know, you talked a little bit about the possibility of merging, which seems to be like the best version of a happy path, whether that's, you know, brain computer interface or uploading our minds, something like that. But is it possible from your perspective that actually sort of the best path forward is to keep AI sort of like roughly where it is, and it's not really worth even talking about if that's impractical, which it also may be. But you know, does that possibility basically exist where we should proceed forward on all technologies? Obviously a core part of your sort of philosophy here is that we should certainly proceed forward on defensive technologies, and even a large number of sort of neutral or kind of hard to say, or even potentially offensive technologies we should proceed with because they generally make the world a better place. But if and when we have an offensive technology or potentially offensive technology that, just like you said, the probability of doom is 10%. Maybe we don't want to roll the dice on that. Like maybe the world is generally good enough that if we keep along all these other dimensions going forward with technological progress, we can make the world like a heck of a lot of a better place without entertaining the possibility that we all die or that we all become pets or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think one of the challenges behind this concept of like, can we just pause AI is basically that like there are huge pressures for AI to keep moving forward. And like, I don't even mean like companies making a profit or people trying to, be cool and based on Twitter. I mean like national governments that want to fight wars. Like, I don't know how much you've been following, like, some of the videos that have been coming out of, Ukraine over the last 1.5 years, or actually, even Armenia and Azerbaijan back in 2020, and some of the other recent wars that have been happening. But, like, automation and drones have been playing huge and decisive roles in all of those theaters, right? Now, in most cases, there's still humans in the loop in a lot of those, right? It's basically, yeah, remote piloting that's happening. And there's like soft norms around the idea that like, hey, we don't want fully automated warfare to happen, right? Recently there was agreements between Xi and Biden, and they agreed to not try too hard to do automated warfare. But like, as soon as there is a really serious conflict that like really seriously directly threatens one or more of these major states' ongoing existence, then people are totally going to say to hell with that and go for maximum automation, right? Probably not even threatens one of the states' existence, probably even threatens some major political regime's existence. And once something like that happens, then like you just have to like look at some of the previous wars to see how quickly technology can progress once there's demand for it, right? Like just how quickly many kinds of technologies escalated during World War One. World War One is generally known as the war where people went in with horses and went out with tanks. And World War II saw a lot. World War II is the war where people went in with tanks and went out with nukes. And who knows what is going to come out on the other end of World War III. So that's like one big pressure for why I expect we're not going to be able to keep the cat out of the bag forever. And then the other thing, of course, is that even in a kind of sub-military context, so there's just like a lot of rationales to have better AI to improve your own productivity. There's rationales to have your own AI to not be under the thumb of the US or China or whoever the largest creators of closed AI are going to be. There's just like a lot of these pressures to keep improving the technology. So I definitely don't think that kind of keeping the technology paused roughly where it is at all realistic in the long term. I mean, if something like that had to be done, then like the vector that you would probably focus on is chip fabs, right? Because you can actually destroy all the chip fabs above some level of quality and like prevent creating new ones, then like at least you've created the ceiling on the hardware side, and then you are going to get algorithmic improvements, but like at least you're not going to create kind of improvements in the amount of flops that the CPUs and GPUs can do. Even that's pretty far-fetched, right? So yeah, I definitely think that there's like a pretty finite clock on before we keep on seeing more and more substantial AI improvements. And so I think the more realistic hope is basically to try to get us into a position where there are other directions for technology that keep humans in the loop somewhat more, right? And there is less radical and more radical versions of this, right? So like the less radical versions of this, I mean, one example of this is some of the ideas in the open agency architecture, which basically tries to kind of split an AI up into different pieces, including like figuring out what the tasks, what the goals are, figuring out what the plans are to achieve a goal, executing on the plans, and then like puts humans in the loop on figuring out and executing on some of those stages. There's just like better AI tools that combine together the role of AIs and the role of people, right? Like, this is something that's just something we need more of, even from a product design standpoint, right? Like, I don't know how much you've tried to use AIs to draw things for specific things that you need, this is just like a pattern that I've noticed, right? It's like when you want an AI to draw something that dazzles you, it succeeds on the first try. When you want an AI to make something specific that you care about for some other objective, you have to like do a whole bunch of like 10 to 20 different edits, and it becomes an incredibly hard challenge, right? And I mean, I even saw the, this pattern to some extent with like the GPTs. I saw this pattern with like Dolly. And so having better human AI interaction and kind of models where you have a human providing input, like let's say once every 500 milliseconds instead of once every 50 seconds, is like something that's super good and powerful, right? But then that's like the less radical version. The more radical version is like, well, realistically, like voice and hands and keyboard and eyes are like still pretty high latency and not very high bandwidth channels. And how do you do even better than that? And there, like, basically is where brain computer interfaces come in. And then in the long term, like, they're realistically, at some point, you just have to get to uploading, right? And if you think about like what that pathway is it's basically saying, instead of growing super intelligence as something that is separate from human beings, let's grow ourselves and grow artificial intelligence together in some kind of pattern where the two weave in with each other. And so the super intelligent thing that comes out at the end actually is like primarily us, instead of being primarily a machine with some kind of maybe at best tenuous connection where we can claim that like we have some kind of control over it. So that's the philosophical thinking behind that direction.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned this as well, that the brain machine thing, like once you get towards merging, despite these other things being, you know, quite scary, just to most people, the brain machine thing sort of takes it to another level, where in the beginning it's trivial and clearly a positive, where you're sort of like, you know, this is what Elon's focus is with Neuralink. You're fixing people who have problems through the brain machine interface, whether it's like Parkinson's or something like that. But later on, you know, it's like people who are otherwise healthy, you're giving them these sort of like superpowers. And on the one hand, that's great in terms of, you know, super intelligence. On the one hand, that's potentially great. On the other hand, if you have, you know, bad actors who get access to that first or something like that, that concerns people. And then the other thing that you touched on more is like, well, what if, you know, the brain machine interface company is like not good and they, you know, it's very centralized. And then suddenly you're literally giving permission to some centralized group to not only read everyone's mind literally, but also potentially write to it. So it's like, it's not a panacea. I mean, I can see the argument why it's maybe sort of the best thing we can drive towards. And then, you know, even a step beyond that, I would think chronologically it would be beyond that, but I'm not totally sure, would be sort of this like upload minds concept. And I'm curious, like from my point of view, you know, I'm not really sure. I find myself wishing that there was better options. And to your point, it's not practical to pause. I actually think your hardware approach, like going about it from that vector, is more practical than, you know, most other things I've heard, where it's you're imposing a physical constraint, which is probably easier to do in order to constrain sort of the digital takeoff in a way. But I'm curious, like, do you know, when you think about the brain machine interface, you think about the uploading of minds as a standalone option, like if you sort of take that and remove it from you know, the alternatives, which seem more obviously worse. Does that feel like a good future to you? Like, does that feel, do you like that? Does that sound good?
Yeah, I think the way that I think about this is like, I expect like the reasonably good case scenario is a future which is amazing from the perspective of a kind of consumerist, the sort of Fukuyama last man sort of archetype, right? Like, you know, like someone who's content with being a sheep as long as they're a happy sheep, but something that has deeply unsatisfying political properties. And I think, like, that is something that makes me uncomfortable. But I think it's also worth acknowledging that, like, the world having less and less satisfying political properties is something that's in some ways been happening over the last couple of hundred years in different ways, right? If you think about, like, for example, one type of freedom that we had even 50 years ago that doesn't exist today, is the freedom to just completely disappear and start a new life, right? And with the level of information technology and surveillance and even ID systems and all of those things that exist, that's like something that is not available anymore, right? But that is something that like within, like even 50 years ago, definitely 100 to 200 years ago, is like totally within the average person's toolbox of like things that might make you feel safe knowing that like no matter what happens, you at least have this option available to you, right? Or another example is like the rise of superpowers and the extent of dominance that they have across the world, right? It's like right now, if the U.S. government wants you in in prison, or if the U.S. government really seriously hates you, then no matter where you are in the world, the amount of space that you're going to have is like pretty constricted, right? And it like it's not even just about like the risk of physical extradition. It's like there have been literally high-level politicians in China that have had credit cards canceled as a result of U.S.-related sanctions, right? Like, so, and then obviously, vice versa as well, right? Like, there's definitely other superpowers that definitely have the ability to make things pretty painful for you if they choose to go after specific people, right? I mean, Vladimir Putin and his friendly cups of tea are probably the example that most people are familiar with, right? And so this idea that like there are agents whose power extends across the entire world is like a thing that like to me it feels like deeply politically uncomfortable. In this, because like if you think about like social contract theory, right? Like this is the standard justification for government that we were taught about in school, right? The idea that like by being part of a country, we agree to follow these rules for because they're for all of our betterments, right? But then you realize that like once you have this concept of countries being able to have impact to this scale across the entire world, and then like the social contract thing kind of becomes really completely fake, right? And so there's just like a lot of these different properties about the world, like ways in which the world becomes less free, also ways in which the world becomes less equal, ways in which barriers that used to exist much less strongly, right? The possibility that like there are software bugs that allow intelligence agencies to watch inside some of our homes, and that like there's a at least single digit probability or even the double digit probability that those kinds of things are happening to any specific person already. These are all deeply politically uncomfortable things about the world that were not true 100 years ago, right? But then at the same time, like, the world is super awesome, and life expectancies are increasing, and the houses are getting bigger, and houses are getting nicer, and we're finally turning a lot of corners and figuring out how to make our food actually healthy, and we're solving air quality problems, and Chinese cities are not smoggy anymore, and like from a Fukuyama last man perspective, like it really does feel like, especially if you kind of look at across the entire world, that like things do sort of keep getting better and better, right? And so like that's one of the ways that I think about this tension, that like we are probably going to just inevitably cross at least like a couple of these big lines that make the world feel extremely politically uncomfortable from the perspective of the kinds of things that we value about the current world make us feel safe, that at least things are like we have like these technical barriers and protections against centralized power being able to harm us, and hopefully we'll be able to like get through this era reasonably well, and maybe, even that trend is going to reverse. Like maybe, with space travel, and once humanity starts colonizing the stars, then like the level of influence over all of humanity that the largest empire can have is going to start decreasing again. I don't know yet, right? The future is like very uncertain in that sense. Like, or is the world going like it does feel like the median case is that the world is going to become somewhat more unequal and somewhat more unfree. And I really dislike that. And I really hope that we can be like one or two units more unequal and more unfree instead of like 100 units on both. I mean, if we can increase on those measures and have a more equal and more free world, then that would be even better. But like, we definitely are facing a lot of lot of challenges from that perspective, right? But I think the thing to keep in mind here, right, is that it's important to think about how like all different paths towards superintelligence have this kind of risk, right? So like, for example, one of the reasons why people are sometimes uncomfortable about biological enhancement of humans is because like it might create a divide between the enhanced and the unenhanced, right? But then if you think about it, like the enhanced and the unenhanced already exist in the form of who can and can't access GPT-4, right? And like it feels like it's less bad because the GPT is one step removed from us as humans instead of being inside of us. But in terms of like real consequences on the world, it's like basically the same, right? And so one of my arguments there is basically that like one is that sort of merging with the AI probably outperforms creating AIs that are separate from us on a lot of these political properties that we care about, but also that like this is also a very good reason why it would be good to have a strong security focused kind of values motivated open source community take as much of the charge on building these things as possible instead of just relying on profit making corporations. I definitely wants to stress that there is like a big necessity in really continuing to push those kinds of values forward, and that like there have been successes already in the sense of like what here's one example of a success, right? Some of the pictures that were in that blog post I made with Adobe Photoshop. Now I run Linux. Photoshop is one of those things that theoretically you can't run on Linux, except now you can. Why? Now, I mean, it might be possible to do it with Wine, but like actually I did not even use that, right? Because now Photoshop runs inside of the browser, and the browser has become so powerful that the browser basically is your operating system, right? And browsers are open source, right? Like, I mean, there are non-open source ones, but like they're all basic, like they're based on either Firefox or WebKit, and both of those are open source. The browsers also have like a lot of sandboxing and a lot of security features built in, right? And so those are definitely our ways in which the world got better, right? Like there definitely was a possible dystopian future where like for security related reasons we would basically all have to ask people for permission in order to install applications, right? Like the world where the Apple way is the only way. But fortunately, we actually have managed to avoid that to some extent, and browsers actually are free in that you can go and go and access any website, and a website can be an application, and they actually also are reasonably secure, right? And so there are like ways that things already are better than they could have been, and I think a big part of that we can't underestimate is like human intention and humans recognizing that like these are political goals that we care about and that we really want. And we are going to act, and we're even going to sacrifice profits in order to act in a particular way to achieve them, right? And that's a spirit that I hope that we can continue to see, especially in some of these spaces that really start like touching, you know, like really closely, you know, like who we are as human beings.
Right. So last question here, because I know we're coming up on time, but I can't help but wonder, you know, what is the role of crypto here? Mm-hmm. Where to your point, like you can't, you know, disappear like you used to be able to. And so that's like sort of a, you know, decrease in freedom there. But crypto in a way enables you to sort of like digitally disappear in a sense. And you sort of allude to this possible future where we have maybe digital privacy, even though we have physical surveillance. Is that a better world that you could envision that could potentially be enabled by crypto?
So this kind of gets into this you know, defensive technology frame that is sort of the heart of the post, right? Where I identified four different types of defense, where I talk about, like, there's defense in the world of atoms and defense in the world of bits. And then in the world of atoms, you have like defense against big things and defense against small things. And defense against big things is like what we normally think of as defense. Defense against small things basically means biodefense. And then in the world of bits, you have cybersecurity, which is like defending against things where if you look at that thing hard enough, you can agree that it's an attacker. And then there is what I call info defense, which is a defending against things where like we might not even necessarily agree like who is attacking and who is defending. And I use misinformation as like a good example there, right? Like misinformation is one of those things that we like lots of people really care about and wants to find ways to go after and reduce. But there's like the big problem that the approaches to fighting misinformation that people come up with by default tends to be approaches that basically say like, here is a centralized actor and we trust the centralized actor and it's going to go and like enforce its opinion on what's good and what's bad across the entire ecosystem. And this will be like the central arbiter of truth, right? And the DEAC approach to info defense basically says, well, can we develop technologies to help fight misinformation that avoid that kind of centralization? And then in cyber defense, like we talked a bit about computer security, but then I think this is where crypto really starts to come in, right? And well, I think crypto comes in two places. One of those places is basically using cryptography and blockchains as tools that let us build digital institutions that are more cyber secured natively, right? Like a thing based on a blockchain cannot be DOS attacked just by taking down one server. A thing based on a blockchain cannot be you know, like hacked and have the database edited just by breaking into one computer, right? A thing based on a blockchain, there is no central operator that you can go after to force them to take the thing down or change the rules of the thing. And this applies to money, like basically giving people an alternative financial system that doesn't depend on any kind of centralized financial rails. It applies to things like identity, right? And so you have, you know, like ENS names, like, you know, like Vitalik.eth. And then I think you have, I think it's like either ofjake.eth or zero ofjake.eth or something like that, right?
Yep.
And then, yeah, it applies to like potentially making more complicated financial contraptions on top of blockchains. And then we can also talk about going beyond blockchains and looking at zero-knowledge proofs in particular, right? Like, I think zero-knowledge proofs are, like, it's the other really big sort of, quote, crypto technology in that they were really born or at least came of age within the same space. But I think they are at least as important as blockchains are. And with zero-knowledge proofs, we can build applications that preserve privacy and like prove things about ourselves at the same time. And so you can prove that you're trustworthy without sacrificing anonymity, right? And this is one of those things that was trialed and used a lot inside of Zuzaloo. Like there was this piece of software called ZooPass that you could use to make a zero-knowledge proof that proves that you're a member of the ZooSolo community without revealing which one you are, right? And then this got used for voting in polls. It got used for accessing websites. It got used for a lot of different things, right? And so you basically have this form of anonymity within a high-trust community, which is like an interesting thing because like that's not something that people are even used to thinking of as something that exists within conventional political discourse, right? Conventional political discourse says that anonymous speech is bad because if you have anonymous speech, then you're going to have 4chan and 8chan, and you're just going to have, you know, like based on non-1488 that keeps talking about how, you know, the Jews are evil. And like, that's like where the quality of discourse stops, right? Like this is, you know, the stereotype of internet anonymity that a lot of people have, right? But, and then you have high trust communities, which have, you know, like real name verification, where of course by real name, they mean, you know, government issued passport name, despite the fact that, you know, like lots of people, like I don't think, like to me, like Satoshi is not Satoshi's passport name, but it was totally a real name because it's like the name by which he did the most significant thing that he did in his life. With these zero-knowledge tools, we can basically create high trust and high privacy at the same time. And there's like a lot of different spaces in which you can combine both in ways that would otherwise not be possible, right? The other example of this actually is going back to the space of cryptocurrency again, right? About a couple of months ago, myself, together with Amin Soleimani and a couple of legal academics, published this paper called Privacy Pools, which is basically an approach to, is it like mixers, right? Things like Tornado Cash. Mixer is the wrong word, right? Because these are, like, mixers are centralized you know, like things that are operated by someone and that you put your money in and they kind of manually do the mixing. These are like smart contracts where you take coins out by providing a proof that you, you know, you are one of the people that put coins in without revealing which one of those people you are. Except instead of taking the Tornado Cash approach where you reveal no information beyond the fact that you are someone who deposited and that you're not double spending, in this case, you reveal extra information. You might reveal something about a subset of, you know, like which set of depositors you are. And so you're able to, for example, you know, prove that you're not on a particular identified list of hackers while still preserving your privacy beyond that, right? And so if someone needs to, you know, like not accept coins that are attached to a sanctions list for compliance purposes, then like someone, the person that they're receiving coins from does not need to like fully reveal everything about themselves. They can just give a zero knowledge proof that says like, hey, this proof proves that these coins have nothing to do with sanctioned activities. And that proof is going to be enough to convince you, even if you have no other information, right? So I think these kinds of technologies that let us have high privacy and high trust at the same time, are like really the core of sort of the DX story in the cybersphere. And so that's where crypto fits into that kind of broader vision of accelerating defensive technology rather than offensive and centralizing technology. And then the other big space is in the infosphere, where the question is like, can we use more of these tools to try to identify, misinformation or identify, context, as Community Notes likes to put it, just like create a healthier information environment. And I mean, one of the two kinds of gadgets there that I'm most excited about, I mean, one is obviously prediction markets, and I've been excited about prediction markets for a long time. And it really feels like prediction markets are finally coming of age, which I think is amazing. And then the other is Community Notes, which is this interesting voting algorithm that I wrote a long post about that basically, it tries to not even identify the note that is the most popular, but identify the note that most consistently gets high ratings from across a wide range of people who normally disagree with each other, right? So basically, you try to elevate the nonpartisan stuff that really rises above the fray and gets a positive review from everyone. So the place where I think crypto comes in, I mean, one is obviously that like a lot of these prediction markets run on crypto. Another is that within the crypto space, there's been a lot of this research and implementation of decentralized governance mechanisms and DAOs and proof of personhood protocols for who can participate in the DAOs and all of these mechanisms. And there's a lot of tools like that can be brought in. And then the third place where it matters is the concept of separating application from interface, right? Like the idea that like you can have the same content, but you can have different views of the content. And to me, one really good example of this is Farcaster, right? Farcaster is basically a decentralized Twitter built on top of Ethereum. But what's interesting about it is like there is the most popular Farcaster client, which is called Warpcast, which just shows you Farcaster and it just looks like a Twitter. But then there is another client, I believe it's called Flink. And if you use it to look at Farcaster messages, then it looks like a Reddit, right? So you literally have the exact same content, the exact same application, at least on the backend level, which is a blockchain, right? It's a combination of Optimism and a dedicated Farcaster chain. And then but then you have these two different sets of glasses that you put on. And it's like, if you put on these glasses, then it looks like a Twitter. If you put on these glasses, then it looks like a Reddit. And to me, that's powerful because it really lowers the barrier to entry in trying to create a better interface. Because if you're going to get into that space, then like, you do not need to like do the work of getting a new user base from scratch, right? You can just immediately go and access the exact same content. And so the network effect barrier gets much lower. There's a lot more room for competition. And then that also creates much more room for people trying to create tools that try to protect users in different ways, right? Like this is one of the things that I talked about, which is that I think that in the crypto space, browsers should be much more active in really trying hard to protect people from scams and getting people to be better informed about what kinds of things they're signing. And the idea here is that like this is another example of like different views on the same content, right? Because the big challenge with creating software like that is that if you try to enforce it across an entire ecosystem, then you're basically enforcing your own idea of what's good and what's bad. And you're doing it in this really centralized way. And you're basically engaging in something that can be probably justly criticized as being censorship. But then if you have this more open ecosystem where you have defaults and people have options, then like you're really kneecapping the downside risk of people being able to do something like that. Because if one of the interfaces starts going crazy and it like, let's say, yeah, decides that anything associated with like the US Democrat Party is a scam or the other way around, then like people can go, well, obviously this is crazy and they can switch to a different interface. But then at the same time, you have like this much more competitive space where people can really try to make the best interfaces possible. And in those interfaces, people would feel more free to try to be much more opinionated than they are within them. So I think that's like, that stuff is also interesting. And I think crypto, basically through blockchains being this kind of decentralized shared hard drive, it really makes this separation between the content and the view much more possible. And so this is like another one of those things that I'm excited about. So yeah, I mean, that's where to me the blockchain and crypto things fit into this broader vision of trying to accelerate defensive technology and basically make the world a more defense favoring place in a way that avoids empowering single centralized actors to decide on behalf of the entire ecosystem or the entire world, like who is the attacker and who isn't the attacker.
Yep. No, I think that's all really great and interesting. And I know we're up on time, so I'll wrap it up there. But appreciate you taking the time. And as always, it's great talking with you. And I know among other things, we've got hope in common for the future of longevity. So hopefully we've got a few hundred years to have a conversation every few years. And definitely encourage people to go, read the blog post that we discussed today. In full and others on Vitalik's website, of course. It's if you're sort of in favor of more nuanced perspectives on things, I think, it might be hard to enforce that or encourage that systematically, but at the very least, you can go and sort of get some more nuanced takes yourself. So thanks again, Vitalik. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, thank you too, Jake. It was great to be here.